It breaks my heart. I am devastated. I have a lump in my throat. It's that upsetting.
The Interior Department says no to the King Cove Cold Bay Road. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, struggling reindeer herders from Western Alaska look to Congress for assistance.
We're going to need help someday revitalizing the industry, so it's these folks out here that are going to be able to help us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell won't allow a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. The Interior Department delivered the news today, about 4 months after the secretary visited the community and the refuge. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Residents of King Cove have been asking the Interior Department for permission to build a one-lane gravel road through Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge for decades. They want easier access to Cold Bay, which has an all-weather airport. The community offered the federal government 60,000 acres in exchange for the small amount of land needed to build the road. Benita Babcock, a community health aide in King Cove, spoke with Jewell when she visited the village in late summer. She says Jewell's decision is devastating.
She came all the way out here. She saw what we were facing, you know, and yet, you know, she still didn't care. It's just a slap in the face. It's insulting.
Babcock says severe weather frequently shuts down air travel in and out of King Cove, and the road is necessary for health and safety reasons. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had previously denied the road because it would disrupt the birds that nest in the refuge and the rare eel grass beds they depend on. Jewell traveled to King Cove in August with Senator Lisa Murkowski, who threatened to hold up Jewell's confirmation until she agreed to a visit. She spent a day touring the community and its medical clinic and spent time in the refuge. At a press conference in Anchorage in September, Jewell said she had a tough decision to make.
I think that there have been efforts to talk about a trade-off between human safety and wildlife, and the reality is I think we want both. And so, you know, I understand the interests on both sides. It's difficult, and I don't think that that's a reasonable trade-off.
The Interior Department wouldn't provide someone to interview for this story. The 20-page decision says construction of a road through Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge would lead to significant degradation of irreplaceable ecological resources that would not be offset by the protection of other lands to be received in the exchange. Murkowski calls Jewell's conclusions heartless. She got a call from Jewell this morning while she was sitting in the Fred Meyer parking lot in Midtown Anchorage, preparing to buy some last-minute Christmas items. Murkowski says the alternatives Jewell is proposing, like building a better dock in Cold Bay, aren't feasible.
I said, I will sit down with you in January when we get back. But right now, I can't even listen to what you are proposing because they are just so inadequate given the situation and the circumstances.
Murkowski says it was especially offensive to King Cove residents to deliver the news 2 days before Christmas. But a long list of environmental groups are praising the decision. They argue the road would have set a precedent and made it easier to build roads through other wilderness areas. Nicole Whittington Evans is Alaska director of the Wilderness Society.
She took in all sides and aspects and came to her own conclusion based on the facts of the issue. And we are celebrating that this wilderness area will remain wild for years to come.
Whittington Evans says she doesn't believe the road is the best alternative to meet health and safety needs in King Cove. King Cove residents say they will never give up their fight to build a road to Cold Bay. And Senator Murkowski echoes that sentiment. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Fite.
The state is suggesting another tactic in financing the Kinnick Arm crossing. Plans for a bridge linking Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna borough hit a snag earlier this year when the state legislature reacted negatively to an audit indicating that toll projections for the first years after the bridge's completion are too optimistic. State lawmakers had also failed to approve the creation of a state reserve to cover shortfalls in toll revenues that project supporters say will pay for bridge construction. Now, Angela Rodell, the State Commissioner of Revenue, says public financing would be the cheapest way to pay for the bridge instead of a public-private partnership.
Under the private-public partnership model, we would have to pay higher costs associated with the financing than we would under a straight public finance model. And since the state was having to make up any shortfall in toll revenues under either scenario, we felt the more prudent course of action was to pursue a public financing model.
There is $55 million in the governor's version of the next budget for the bridge, although the State Department of Revenue has been asked to further evaluate the project's financing system. The department has a contract with First Southwest Company, which has outlined a plan to raise $262 million in bridge construction costs through the sale of bonds. The so-called Public-Private Partnership, or P3 plan, has been the financing model that the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, or KABATA, has been pursuing since the agency was charged with moving the bridge from the drawing board to reality. Rodell, who sits on the KABATA Board of Directors, says she wants to move debate over the Kinnick Arm crossing away from the argument of toll revenues and whether or not there will be enough to finance the bridge. She says that under a private financing plan, the state's excellent credit rating would be key.
It's just a difference in credit rating. The state would be able to issue bonds with a AA+ credit rating. The private consortium would have to issue them with a BBB.
Lower interest rates would mean savings, and the cost of the bridge could be paid back within 20 years, Rodell says, as opposed to 35 years under the P3 plan. And Rodell says if toll revenues from the bridge are higher than projected, the extra income could be put into the state's general fund. Another investor in the proposed Pebble Mine says it may back out. Rio Tinto announced today it will perform a strategic review of its investment in the controversial gold and copper mine in the Bristol Bay region, and the review will consider divestment. Rio Tinto holds about 19% of Northern Dynasty, which became the sole owner of the project after mining conglomerate Anglo American pulled out in September. Northern Dynasty CEO Ron Thiessen told investors in a conference call this morning the announcement came as a complete surprise, and he would be seeking new investors in early 2014. Pebble Partnership CEO John Shively declined to comment for the story. Two of Rio Tinto's large investors, the chief financial officers of New York City and the state of California, have been pressing Rio Tinto to reconsider its Pebble investment. They cited, among other reasons, the reputation risk to any company associated with the mine. Pebble opponents say the project could destroy the Bristol Bay salmon fisheries and devastate the communities in the region. Rio Tinto says it will consider Pebble's fit with its investment strategy and its strategy for copper projects elsewhere. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell today certified a citizen ballot initiative that, if passed, would require legislative approval of a large-scale mine in the Bristol Bay watershed. It would also require a finding that the mine prospect not endanger the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. Sponsors will need to gather more than 30,000 signatures and meet other rules before the initiative would go to voters. A vehicle crash this morning has claimed the life of 61-year-old Richard Leo of Trapper Creek. According to Trooper spokeswoman Beth Ipson, Richard Leo's vehicle was traveling southbound near Mile 11 on the Talkeetna Spur Road when he lost control and crossed into the northbound lane, sliding sideways. A Sunshine Transit shuttle was traveling northbound and hit Leo's vehicle on the passenger side. Richard Leo and the four dogs in his vehicle were killed in the collision. The driver of the Sunshine Transit van is unhurt, according to the troopers, and was carrying no passengers. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what do you do if you want a Christmas tree but live in a treeless Alaskan community?
It is basically a conical structure made out of books, resulting in a Christmas tree-like shape.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Here's a story about reindeer that has nothing to do with Santa. The reindeer herders of the Seward Peninsula have endured years of declining stocks. Once they had more than 100,000 animals, now it's down to about 20,000, and the industry teeters on the edge of viability. Koerik Reindeer Herders Association sent a delegation to Washington, D.C. earlier this month to see if the federal government can help. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Tom Gray of White Mountain has lost his whole reindeer herd. The problem is caribou. Their population is booming. They used to stay off the Seward Peninsula, but now they overwhelm the reindeer range during their winter migration. When they leave, reindeer leave with them. Gray, who is president of the Reindeer Herders Association, believes the caribou numbers will subside eventually, and he wants the herders to be ready to rebuild. So he came to Washington to look for help among the agencies and congressional offices.
Until the caribou quit coming, there's not a whole lot we can do other than try and figure out who can help us and who we need to know in the system. And, we understand we have to help ourselves, but there's also programs out there that can help us.
So in addition to meetings and office visits, the herders held a reception. The idea was to showcase their product, present a slideshow to illustrate their situation, and, says Gray, meet people.
We're going to need help someday revitalizing the industry, so it's these folks out here that are going to be able to help us. We don't know these folks, so first thing we need to do is understand Washington, understand the people.
The reception was sparsely attended, despite the exotic hors d'oeuvres. Chef Rob Kneen flew in from Anchorage for it.
I took the prime cuts of the reindeer, so the tenderloin, the rib, the New York, and I coated it with Creole spice and coffee and seared it. And then we finished it with a lingonberry or highbush cranberry aioli.
Inupiat Eskimos have been herding reindeer on the Seward Peninsula since the 1890s, when the animals were imported from Siberia. In the 1920s and 30s, Alaska reindeer was heavily marketed and available in hotel restaurants around the U.S. Gary Finstad, a reindeer expert at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says the industry is now at such a low point that production can't even keep up with in-state demand, so meat from Canada and Europe fills the gap.
As a program manager for the reindeer research program, I am embarrassed about that. We have to import reindeer meat into the state of Alaska to produce Alaskan reindeer sausage. And we need to change that. And that's one of the reasons we're here.
One problem is a lack of government-inspected slaughter facilities on the Seward Peninsula. Without them, the meat can't be sold nationwide. Finstad hopes mobile slaughter units can be deployed to serve the industry.
You know, we're having problems that the cattle industry had probably in the 1920s and 1930s, and we're dealing with those problems today, you know, predation and rustling and, you know, no infrastructure and difficult to get products to market.
But livestock producers benefited from $58 million in federal subsidies last year, according to the Environmental Working Group. The Seward Peninsula reindeer herders are mostly shut out of those programs. Finstad says it's because the government doesn't see the reindeer as livestock, and the traditional meat producers want to keep it that way.
We would offer some very stiff competition. We put out a beautiful meat product, low fat, low cholesterol, high protein, high mineral, very tender. And it's raised on in pristine conditions, pristine ranges, a very wholesome, wonderful product.
So maybe someday, if the caribou leave, if the reindeer herders rebuild their stock, if they solve their production problems, maybe someday reindeer will sit beside bison in American supermarkets. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Juneau Animal Control only labels dogs as dangerous or potentially dangerous as a last resort. Last week, an animal control official urged the Juneau Assembly not to adopt breed-specific legislation in response to attacks. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Banning or restricting the ownership of certain dog breeds does little to prevent attacks or increase public safety. That's according to Dr. Christopher Pockel, a board-certified veterinary behaviorist who practices at the Animal Behavior Clinic in Portland, Oregon.
Enforcement becomes an issue. So unless you've got a plan in place to be able to actually enforce breed-specific legislation, the idea that it's going to magically have an effect on safety is sort of misguided. The other piece of it is any breed of dog is capable and potentially would engage in those behaviors that led to those incidents.
Pockel hasn't treated any of the dogs involved in two recent attacks in Juneau, but he sees animals in his practice all the time that display aggressive tendencies. He says breed can be a factor in dog aggression, but it's not the only factor.
That would be almost like saying every border collie is an amazing herder, or that every Labrador is an amazing hunter. That's just not true. There's going to be a tremendous variation within that breed profile as to how likely that particular animal is to engage in certain behaviors.
Pockel says it's important for dog owners to know their pet and what might trigger them to behave a certain way. That, too, can vary from dog to dog. He says some are fear biters, others are territorial. Still others might have another trigger. He recommends positive reinforcement, like treats, to encourage good behavior.
So the dog is motivated to think or respond in a particular way because of the fact that that's the emotion or the behavior that's been reinforced.
He says the problem with using punishment or negative reinforcement is that it needs to be done consistently with perfect timing and intensity every time the dog displays bad behavior.
If those rules are not implemented correctly, we actually increase fear and anxiety because something unpleasant is happening, but in an unpredictable or inconsistent manner.
Juneau Animal Control Director Matt Musselwhite this week recommended the City Assembly not pass any laws targeting specific dog breeds. While pit bulls and pit mixes were responsible for two recent attacks, Musselwhite said the breed doesn't even rank in the top three for dog bites reported in the capital city. He said there are currently 14 dogs deemed dangerous or potentially dangerous in Juneau, and he listed some of the requirements those dogs' owners must meet to protect public safety.
$100,000 in liability insurance to be carried by the owner. Signs posted to indicate that a dangerous animal lives on the premises. The animal must wear a special dangerous dog collar and tags. And when outside the residence, the animal must be muzzled and controlled by a leash no longer than 4 feet.
According to Musselwhite, animal control tries to work with dog owners to address any behavior problems before labeling a dog as dangerous or potentially dangerous. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message is sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
The WAMI program is the only option for Alaskans who want to stay in the state for part of medical school, and it's about to undergo changes that will reshape when and where students can attend classes. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Only around a quarter of the students who apply for the Alaska branch of the WAMI program are accepted. And once they are, students spend 2 years in classrooms and labs, followed by another 2 years of clinical rotations. Right now, at least one of those years is spent outside Alaska. Monica Wright is a third-year medical student and a married mother of two. She says spending time away from her home and family was a challenge.
I had to pay for an apartment for 9 months out in Seattle, so it's kind of like maintaining two households while, being in medical school was a little bit tough. I was able to fly home once a month to see my family, but that was another kind of added expense. So it was challenging. You talk on the phone every night and do what you can.
Wright wishes she'd been able to stay in Alaska. Future Whammy students will have that option starting in the fall of 2015. Alaska Whammy Director Dr. Nancy Jane Shelby.
We're very close to having the possibility for Alaska students to do all 4 years here in Alaska if they so choose.
For most students, staying in Alaska will be cheaper and easier. The change is possible because of a dramatic curriculum overhaul. Shelby says the new curriculum will focus on more active learning instead of lectures. And by reorganizing classes, it should help ease the transition for students as they enter different phases of their education.
So a student, instead of learning what's normal the first year, what's abnormal the second year, and then be expected in their third year clerkship to integrate all this and remember what they learned 2 years ago, we're going to do it on a more natural continuum of learning experience for the students.
Shelby expects to hire more staff to help handle the second year students who would normally be out of state. The Alaska Whammy program also wants to grow. They accept 20 new students each year, but in order to meet the physician workforce demands of the state, Shelby says they need to at least double that number. And she thinks that's doable.
I'm quite impressed with what I'm seeing in terms of high school and undergraduate students in Alaska. From all parts of Alaska, I think we do have that pipeline that we can develop so that we could have 40 outstanding students each year in our class.
As the program grows, Shelby hopes to see more students go on to work in Alaska's underserved rural communities.
We're hoping that by recruiting students from rural and more remote areas, or students that have a particular interest in eventually practicing there, that will increase that recruitment of physicians to those areas.
Shelby says approximately 8 of every 10 students who go through Alaska's Whammy program return to practice in the state for at least 5 years. And she thinks that's a pretty good return. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Cutting down a Christmas tree is a venerated tradition for many. But in Alaska, there are places where there simply aren't trees to cut down. Stephanie Joyce brings us this story about Christmas in the Aleutians.
Growing up in Juneau, cutting down a tree was a family tradition. We'd drive up the icy road toward Eagle Crest ski area, faces thrust out the window into the freezing wind, searching for a perfectly shaped tree. Then there was the sweaty back and forth of trying to get a rusty handsaw to make even a small dent in the bark. Eventually, we'd slip and slide down the hill, dragging the tree behind us, and then spend hours trying to get it to stand up straight. Yes, hours. There's a reason none of us are engineers. Of course, the Aleutians are in Alaska, too. But anyone who's been there can tell you, they're nothing like Juneau. There are no soft, snowy nights in the Aleutians in December. The temperatures hover on the harsh borderline between snow and rain, and the winds are usually howling along at 60 miles an hour. On top of that, the islands are mostly treeless. There are a few specimens left over from when Russia owned the state, small hunchback trees that have spent their entire lives fighting against the gales that got the chain its nickname as the birthplace of the winds. But cutting down an anemic old tree that somehow made it to age 200 is hardly in the Christmas spirit. It would be like hacking up Scrooge and sticking him in the living room under a layer of twinkle lights. So when I drew the Christmas shift my first year reporting in the Aleutians, I resigned myself to a treeless holiday. But my roommate and colleague, Alexandra, who listeners will know better as APRN's Capitol correspondent, had different ideas. When I walked into the living room one night in December, I briefly thought a major earthquake had struck while I was driving home. The entire floor was awash in books. And in the middle of the pile, Alexandra.
Yeah, it was a complete mess.
What were you doing?
I was making a Christmas book tree.
A Christmas book tree, you ask?
It is basically a conical structure made out of books where you lay out the books in rings on the floor and then you progressively stack smaller rings onto them, resulting in a Christmas tree-like shape. And then to make it really look like a Christmas tree, you can wrap it up in Christmas lights.
Being journalists, we had plenty of material to work with, from a monster copy of Crime and Punishment all the way down to the little prince. But if standing up a tree is hard, standing up a book tree is a serious engineering problem.
It's kind of like Jenga, but in reverse, where in Jenga, you know, you take pieces out and it causes everything to fall. When you're making a Christmas book tree, you are building up and building up, but it's not like you're dealing with uniform blocks. You're dealing with books of different, you know, sizes and shapes and weights. So it takes a lot of care and a lot of balance to get things just right.
And of course, being in the proper holiday spirit, the eggnog just might have come out. But several failed attempts and a healthy dose of whiskey later, we stood back to admire our handiwork. A mostly upright, 4-foot-tall tower of books wrapped in shining holiday lights. A critical element was missing, though. We didn't have a star for the top of the tree. Improvising, I picked up the now nearly empty bottle of Maker's Mark, plopped it on top of the Christmas book tree, and gave a cheers for holiday cheer. Traditional? Not quite. But one learns to improvise living on a treeless island in the middle of the Bering Sea. I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Kids at Unalaska's United Methodist Church got to tell the story of Christmas during their annual Living Nativity scene last week. 15 elementary school kids from the congregation dressed up as wise men, shepherds, and angels. Pastor Dan Wilcox helped lead the show.
Angels in the second back row.
Normally we have an argument over who's Mary and who's Joseph, but this time it was who's going to be the angels and shepherds instead.
As the angel choir withdrew to heaven, the shepherds talked it over. Let's go over to Bethlehem as fast as we can. They left running. Running. And found Mary and Joseph for the baby.
Yeah, we call it a live nativity, although they normally involve live animals. We don't do that here, so mainly because we don't have many camels on the island. We really do it for the kids because I think it's important for them to learn the Christmas story. And I think by acting it out and telling the story and singing the hymns and the carols, that it helps them know what the song or what the story is.
The Living Nativity is part of Kids Night Out, a weekly after-school get-together for children at the church. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. We had commentary from former Unalaska resident Stephanie Joyce. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.